Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Please join me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the blessed, noble, and fully self-awakened one. So, as I say, this is aimed at people who are new or partly new, etc., etc. Just to be very clear as to the three things you need to know. You need to know what the Buddha means by right awareness. And we need to know how to deal with stuff that comes up that takes us away from right awareness. And we need to know what it is we're supposed to be investigating. Right? It's no point in investigating something if it's the wrong investigation. So to get the right awareness clear, I usually go through the Buddha's little life story. I go through the Buddha's life story as quickly as I can, just so that you get the drift of it. So remember, he left home in what we would recognize as an existential crisis. He's put in that mythological way that he was out one day and he saw somebody was sick, somebody old, very old, a corpse, and somebody sitting under a tree. And this awakened in him the desire to escape suffering. So that was the obsession of the age, really, that this whole idea of rebirth, keep coming back as a human or a cow or something, trying to get out of that cycle. And there were materialists who said there was no such thing, that when you're dead, you're dead. So he wandered off from his family to live with the Samanas. They were a group of people, a bit like the hippies of the 70s, who left the regular society to come and do various sorts of meditation techniques and mortification exercises in order to see if they could find this escape from suffering, escape from rebirth. So the first two teachers he went to taught him how to develop these ecstasies that you can do inside yourself. So these are done by, in every religion, through repetitive prayer, through visualizations and stuff. And basically, as we'll be doing metta this afternoon, or the breath that we've been doing. So you don't use the breath to investigate, just get into the feel of it. And let that gentle feeling just bring a certain quietness, stillness, and it'll take you into an inner ecstasy, you see. So you can see that once you can just sit there and get yourself completely blissed out, well, what do you need? You need a tree, a loincloth, and a bit of food, isn't it? That's all you want, and then you're happy. Unfortunately, whenever he came out of these blissful states, he was just back to being miserable. So he tried self-mortification. This is how it runs in the scriptures. We're not so sure as to the sequence of these things, but he definitely tried this self-mortification, which was really, I think, through the examples of the Jaina, and the Mahavira. That's how they call the one who founded that religion. So there, the idea was that karma, the consequences of past actions, past unwholesome actions, actually manifested as matter. So your body was your karma. And in order to escape the consequence of karma, one way was basically to starve the body of its pleasures and its needs. So the problem was in the body. It wasn't that you were greedy, it was just that the body had appetite. So in the Jaina religion, it's often you get people who will slowly starve themselves to death on the understanding that they're letting go of the body so the soul can rise naturally to heaven, you see. Well, the Buddha tried that, but he determined after a while that it was just more suffering. So he left his companions, who thought he'd gone soft. And so the tale goes, he's obviously feeling quite dejected, standing on this road or somewhere. And a woman comes along, we still have her name, it seems, Sujata, which means an auspicious birth. And she's carrying some sweetmeats to offer to a local shrine, local god at a shrine. Seeing this miserable wretch, I think she was moved to offer it to him. Although it says in the scriptures he looked like a god. Well, we'll see. So anyway, she gives him this little sweetmeat. And just around this time, he has a memory of watching his father doing the ploughing ceremony. And he recognizes that as a child watching his father doing the plowing ceremony, he was as concentrated, as connected as he was with these exercises. But there was something extra. And it was this inquisitiveness, you know, like, what is my daddy doing? So somehow this helped him to reverse the whole process. Instead of trying to achieve happiness, he began to look inward to see how he was creating suffering. And it was with that inspiration, it seems, he sat under a tree, what we call the religious Bodhi tree, because he sat under it, the religious fig tree, and determined that he would crack this problem or die. It's a heavy determination, huh? Well, lucky for him, I say, and lucky for us, it took him 6 hours. a mere 6 hours. And then he sat there, it seems, for a few days, just pondering, just realizing what he'd actually discovered. And such was the subtlety of his discovery that he didn't think anybody really understand. But then, again, it's put mythologically, God came down and said, well, there's some with only a little bit of dust in their eyes. And so with that, he went to search his old companions. Now, the point of the story is to see what he means by right awareness. So if we go back to that child mind, when we see children who see, for instance, a bug or something, a beetle, that they've never seen before, you can see they lock onto it, don't they? They just completely absorb onto this little creature. And their eyes are locked onto it, which is the manifestation of their concentration. Yeah, but the jaw drops, doesn't it? They look gormless, you know, and you want to wake them up. And that jaw dropping means there's no thinking. Right? The jaw, the tongue are intimately connected with your thought pattern. So there they are looking gormless. See how the object, and they're absorbing. And at some point when they've absorbed enough, that's when they turn round and ask mummy or daddy, what is it? And they say, well, it's a beetle. Now, what the child does is, he now has a label, beetle, okay? So the next beetle he sees, he's not at all interested in the beetle. He's interested in naming it. And he says to mummy and daddy, a beetle, and they say, wonderful, that's very good. But from that point on, the child never experiences a beetle again. What they do is they plonk their concept onto that beetle and give it a name, and that's it. Right? Now, that's what we're doing all the time. We're all the time experiencing life through our concepts. And our concepts hold our history. So we're locked into this conceptual world which sees everything, which sees everything and names everything through concepts. So as soon as you see something, you see flowers. See? I mean, I saw the flowers. I haven't looked at them. I haven't smelt them. I haven't done anything. I've just thought, oh, flowers. See? And I turned away. Flowers, very, very pretty. And that's it. It's gone. Right? And it fits into my idea of a bouquet. So, oh, it's a flower. It's gone. But I haven't experienced them. In order to experience them, I've got to sit there and really let the eye rest on it. Huh? And that's when I begin to actually see this rose. See what I mean? So I've got to go back to the sense bases, got to go right back to the actual sensation coming in, to go back to that clarity that I had as a child. See? And that's right awareness. That's what he means by right awareness. He means that you actually are going into your experience before you give it a name. So what is pain, for instance? So when you look at pain in the knee, you might say your first thing will be, oh, pain or discomfort, whatever you see, pain, you see? And then you notice that you've got this reaction of wanting to move away, and you feel that, you wait for that to pass, then you're back to this pain, okay? Then what you do is you go into the pain, right? So the Buddha is very clear, he uses phrases which translate as to see feelings in feelings, to see sensations in sensations. He actually uses that form of Pali, right? And you go into the pain, and your noting will change. It'll be tightness, it'll be heat, it'll be something else. But the word pain will disappear, right? And then when you come out to that second level of perception, which gives the sensation a meaning, pain, you realize that pain is a mental construct. It doesn't exist. What actually exists are these sensations. Now, it doesn't mean to say that you've got to lose the concept of pain, because you need to know when to go to the doctor, right? But now you know, Pain is a mental construct. And as soon as you say pain, you get the reaction to it of not wanting it. Right? But when you go down to the direct perception of sensations, there's not only no pain, there's no reaction, there's no suffering. Yeah? Now this can be translated onto painful people. Right? Painful people are a concept. Right? What that is just the person in front of you. Right? And so you begin to undermine this whole reactive way that we've taught ourselves to be, as a relationship to the world of pain. In the same way, it's the same with pleasure. So with pleasure, or anything that excites us or pleases us, we try to hold on to it, we try to develop it, right? But we don't realize that when you indulge something, you're actually building up a future of pain and horror. Right? Because once you're attached to something, which means to say that your happiness is dependent on something, right? Ice cream. If there's no ice cream, there's grief, isn't there? And then there's frustration when you can't get it. And there's the fear of loss. So you've got to have some in the freezer, just in case. Yeah? And there's all sorts of insurance policies. And then, of course, there's this boredom. So every time you indulge something, after a while, it becomes boring, right? That's why we have so many types of chocolate, so many types of sweets, because you can't keep sucking the blackcurrant gobstopper. You've got to have something else. So we're constantly searching for this happiness. And we presume that the mental state that arises, which actually is a form of excitement, is happiness. We're constantly chasing the dragon, right? Right? That's the addiction we get from being obsessed over trying to be happy or trying to be in a state of pleasure. So when we sit in meditation, these come up as our hindrances. Right? Everything we desire starts appearing. Everything that we don't like starts appearing. Everything we're afraid of and worried about. Everything that makes us restless. All this stuff starts coming up, you see. So what are you going to do? Well, you find you can't do anything at all. All you can do is bear it, right? And observe it, and observe your desire to get rid of things or to indulge things. And when that goes away, you're still left with this raw material coming out of the heart, seeking escape from suffering or indulgence in pleasure or happiness. Right? Now, what can you do? You can't do anything. You have to sit there. See, that's purgatory. Now, purgatory is a wonderful place because there is a healing going on. See, it's not hell. Hell, there's no healing. That's it. You despair when you're in hell. But when you're in purgatory, everything's slowly getting better. Now, it might not feel like that. So you've got to stay with it until you can see that these things finally exhaust themselves. And every time you do that, you're undermining a certain conditioning which was causing this problem in the first place. And that's how you deal with all the stuff that comes up. The one that doesn't excite you but sends you into a sweet oblivion are these states of dullness, lethargy, etc. Now the problem with the wonderful thing about oblivion is there is no suffering. But the problem is you keep waking up. And what you realize is that although the body and the mind need sleep, that's not a problem. We like to be in that place as a sort of escape mechanism. Yeah? How many times have you felt bored, a bit depressed, and you've just sunk into that sofa, or gone for what somebody calls a duvet dive? You sort of just bury yourself underneath it, and you might come out feeling better, but that's not guaranteed. So there's a level of our tiredness which is actually to do with indulgence, indulging that state of sleepiness, or indulging that state of oblivion. And that, of course, is a conditioning within us, right? It's actually something which is a habit. So you sit in here in meditation, and I can't think of anything more boring than watching the breath. It doesn't excite you at all. And before you know it, you're just nodding off. So we overcome that, of course, by remaining awake at all costs. Refuse to be annihilated, okay? So you lift your spine, you open your eyes, you stand up, you do anything just to keep yourself awake and aware of that drag, of that whirlpool dragging you down, right? So that's how you deal with these two types of hindrances. One's always exciting, one's like a whirlwind, and you just have to bear with it, feel it, and wait for it to exhaust its energy. And in the same way, the whirlpool, that drawing down into oblivion, you've got to feel that energy wanting to take you down until it completely goes. Now, when these energies go, they don't disappear. You've not lost energy or anything. No, they always transform towards their opposite. So where you found yourself being all irritated, you might find yourself suddenly being all understanding and calm and compassionate. And where you found yourself being cruel, you find yourself being compassionate, and so on and so forth. So that whole process of a movement from negativity to what's positive, from unwholesome to wholesomeness, actually happens quite naturally. So in Zen they'll say, wisdom, compassion arises naturally with wisdom. It just rises with it. Okay? Again, this is the magic of the system, that you don't have to do anything except bear, which is enough. You have to bear with things. And you've got to begin to understand how you're creating this suffering because of our reactivity. Right? Always reacting rather than wise response. And then finally, what we're observing is that business of desire. It's difficult to translate the original Pali word because it's a specific desire. It's the desire that's causing you suffering. So the desire to meditate would not be considered a bad desire, all right? But all the desires around greed and aversion and all the vices that we have, all those desires are to be seen and to be allowed to exhaust themselves, you see? And that, when we see the role of that desire, what the Buddha's pointing to is that this is the direct psychological cause for suffering. But there are, of course, deeper causes, and the deep one is to do with identity. So thinking that we are human beings. A dreadful mistake, right? Conventionally, there's not a problem. But ultimately, of course, it's bad news, isn't it? Because you die. So it's beginning to investigate this psychophysical process to see if there's anything in it which isn't changing. To see if there's anything in it which does not actually, is of a completely different order, of a completely different nature. Now, you can't see that. What you can see clearly is what is arising and passing away, what is not actually permanent. So that's your next thing, is to see if there's anything that you're observing and aware of which isn't arising and passing away. And in so doing, we may be able to see something or experience something which isn't. It's not arising and passing away. Right? The Buddha says that nirvana is permanent. It doesn't arise and pass away. It is not born and it doesn't die. Right? And then there's to do with control. Now, if you say me, presuming that when we say me or I am the center of control. I'm the one who decides things, and I'm the one who does things. But in meditation, realize that everything's happening whether you want it to or not. Yeah? I mean, pain in the knee, you don't sit down thinking, well, now I'm going to have pain in my knee. So it's recognizing that all this stuff, once you've accessed this position of the observer, the feeler in yourself, has another center of control. So it can't be you. And it's slowly undermining this ideas of continuity, that I'm the same person day in and day out, the idea of substantiality, I am this body, I am this emotion. It's constantly undermining that. That's beginning to make us realize that there's something in this whole mass of psychophysical organism which isn't part of that phenomenal process. That's the spiritual aim. I can only hope my words have been of some assistance, that it has not caused even further confusion, and that you will, by your practice, eventually save yourself from greater suffering. Thank you. So are there any immediate questions? Some confusion somewhere? So don't forget the child's mind for right awareness. How to deal with hindrances, right? Well, things that go away, just keep bringing yourself back to the present moment. Observe them, feel them in the body. Sleepiness, you just keep waking up. And you're observing impermanence and the fact of where the center of control is, etc. Okay. So a little bit more walking, just to, let's say that if we do